This is Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
The collective spirit of Israel has been rekindled. After 6 months of street protests brought about by political turmoil and the division it sowed, the Israel we know and love has responded to the disaster of October the 7th with utter societal unity. Ground up, not bottom down. The grist and ideals of Israeli and Jewish society, the IDF, the collective us, unites Israel in action. A phenomenon our guest today says will change both the Middle East and Israel for good. Benny Davidson is an Entebbe hostage survivor, now aged 60, just 13 years old when he and his family were among those freed in that legendary Israeli raid in July 1976. Benny lectures around the world on hostage trauma, and he says he would go to the ends of the earth to support Israel. This is insight into what hostages will be going through, what can and should be done to get the 200 babies, elderly, and whole families out of Gazan hell. He calls for more support for the families of the hostages, something he and his brother Ron have already started to do. His parents in their late 80s are still with us, and he has a stirring tribute to them in love and respect. It was their quick thinking under pressure back then which has formed him. Benny also pays a deeply emotional tribute to Yoni Netanyahu, brother of Benjamin, who commanded Sayeret Matkal at Entebbe and gave his life that day. Our coverage of Israel's pogrom is underway. Scroll back one episode for the former senior national security advisor Chuck Freilich, who gives us the military and strategic options which face the IDF.
A large number of civilians and women with infants, grandparents, and that's certainly going to have a big effect on the government and constrain its freedom of action. But Hamas has apparently spread them all over the Gaza Strip. I think that we will have to do what we have to do and try and do it in such a way that minimizes the dangers to the hostages, but we'll have to go ahead in any event. We cannot allow ourselves to be held hostage as a nation by a terrorist organization like Hamas.
And his thoughts on the diplomatic aftermath. If you enjoy my podcast, tell your friends. Subscribe and follow now if you haven't already. And you can buy me a coffee, buymeacoffee.com/Johnny Gould, because it's such a morale booster, and thank you for doing so. Benny Davidson, former Entebbe hostage, welcome to Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
Thank you, Johnny.
Benny, you must have recoiled in horror at seeing a new generation of hostages taken captive. You saw the horror in their eyes.
I understand what's going through the hostages, and I understand personally what's going on with their families. And I understand their need to be heard and to have a strong support so people will stand with them and demand, like our families and the public in Israel 47 years ago, stood in the street and protested to make sure that we come back home. Of course, nobody knew about the brilliant rescue operation. Nobody knew, except those who needed to know. And I think I would bet that the IDF is doing whatever it can do and then some to locate and devise a plan to do what's needed. And the thing that is needed is to bring them safe home. Having said that, you asked me, you know, there is a war with Hamas now, so what needs to be done? And I, right at the first, said that I'm no general. I served in the army in a special intelligence corps unit, but I'm no general and I'm not a combatant. But I have lots of friends from Sayeret Matkal back in the days from Entebbe, and later on, they're all good friends of mine. So this is a different and very, very complex situation. This is not, you know, a raid of Entebbe like a raid on Gaza and you simply bring them out. It's not that simple, but I truly not just hope, but believe Israel has the capability to demand and ensure that Hamas releases all these hostages free and clear, or else. And to put it in Biden's words, don't. He was talking to Hezbollah and Iran, but I'm talking to the monstrous from the hellish of hell in Hamas. Simply don't. If you want anything to be left to rebuild Gaza at some point in the future, you'd better bring them back home now. Not tomorrow, not a day after, but now.
You were just 13 years old when you and your family were among hostages held at the legendary airport siege. And you were freed in a daring Israeli raid. And you have since lectured on hostage trauma. Can you give us insight, first of all, on what our hostages will be going through? What should be done? What can be done in this most urgent and random of crises?
Well, you're asking
big questions.
One, but very entangled with others, complicated questions, I would say. So first and foremost, I have to state, I'm not a politician, nor am I a statesman, nor am I a brigadier general in the Israeli Defense Forces. Whatever you hear from me should be taken into account as an ex-hostage and as a 60-year-old father of four, second time married to a lovely mother of additional three, and owning also three dogs. So having said that, let me try to dismantle your very complex and rightfully so question, because we're living in complex times. I would rather it would be easier and straightforward. To me, it's having seen what we've seen, and after the first shock, for me at least, the picture and what needs to be done is very, very clear, but I assume I'm oversimplifying very, very complicated situations. So let's go for the hostages first. I can tell you, I visited the hostages' families. It was very emotional for them, hearing that a hostage from Entebbe is coming to support them. And I sat with them for a couple of hours in Kaplan, in Tel Aviv, in Kaplan Street. It's not even a demonstration. They're sitting in small tents and requesting, basically, on the other side of the street where the government sits, where the prime minister sits, they are demanding the return of their loved ones, harmless. And that's what they should do. And both my older brother, Ron, and myself, who were both in Entebbe, decided that it's time for us as ex-Entebbe hostages to contribute, supporting and standing with the families in their rightfully demand from the IDF and from the government of Israel to give it top priority. And it was, you know, extremely sad. And one point that I'd like to make up is that there are not enough people in the streets with them yet. And I understand that, you know, people are at war, afraid to go outside. A lot of people got recruited, busy with casualties, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I hope and predict that many more people will come and simply sit with them and support them. Now, yes, I went through a hijack of an airplane and a week in Entebbe. And I have nothing but very strong emotions and feeling for the 200. I know what they're going through. I you can see the horror in their eyes when they were abducted from their homes and walked or mounted on motorcycles or jeeps or cars to Gaza. So I really feel for them, and I'll continue to visit them to give them strength, because what they need now, the families and the hostages, is strength. And it reminds me of the initial, even seconds taking control of the airplane a few minutes after we took off in Athens, when we heard the scream of the French stewardess from first class. My mother told my father, "Uzi, the airplane is kidnapped." And he told her, "Sala, you're afraid of everything. So probably somebody doesn't feel well in first class. All is good." It didn't take more than a few seconds for the stewardess to walk back on the aisle towards our class, pale as a wall, with the German terrorist walking behind her, holding a gun to her head and waving a grenade in another. In parallel, two Arab passengers who embarked the airplane on Athens, who sat one row behind us. We were sitting in the four middle seats, like two or three rows from the end of the Airbus, rose and started running front and back with the grenades and handguns waving. This airplane is hijacked. So you can imagine all hell broke loose in the airplane, screaming, yelling, shouting, crying, a complete hysteria.
But you talk also about the bravery and courage of your father, who had some training and experience, and your mother too.
And mother, and afraid of flights, but a hero by herself.
Wonderful.
But what cemented in me, Johnny, in those initial few minutes, my father, who sat on the right aisle, took a quick look to the left, to my mother, who sat beside him, to me, who sat beside her, and to my brother, Ron, who sat on the left aisle. The four of us were together. He said, "Move a little front with your tushes. So you sit low in your seats, and you, so if a gun blasts off, you're keeping safe. Quiet, quick, sharp, smart command. No crying, no yelling, no hysteria." There were a couple of other things that my parents did in those initial minutes, like my father finding out that his Israeli Air Force navigator certificate is on him. He was a captain at the Israeli Air Force, an active navigator, not an active in reserves. And that's a proof that you don't want the terrorists to know. So you can go hysteric, or you can be my father. He tore it to four parts. Each one of us got one quarter of it. We continued to take it apart, chewed it, made small paper balls out of it, and threw it in a soft brick can, and it's gone. So there were a couple of other things in those initial moments that made the potential trauma becoming a pillar of strength for me.
Are you playing catch up with Johnny Gould's Jewish State? I've had the pleasure of some really great guests. How about Douglas Murray?
Israel is a rare country in the West in that it does buck many of the trends. There isn't a fertility rate problem in Israel, for instance, as there is in most European countries. There is a strong feeling of nationhood and of the debts that the country needs to call upon in order to unite its people.
and Hillel Neuer, whose UN Watch keeps check on the excesses and mission creep of the UN human rights in Geneva.
The challenges are great. They're not going away. I am concerned by the cultural revolution that we've experienced in America in the past 5 years, known to some as the woke revolution, where there's a kind of a McCarthyism. If you say something, it could be canceled and fired from your university, from your corporation, from a journalist. And often it's an anti-liberalism. So that, to be honest, really scares me, because we need our democracies to be healthy, to be honest, to be truth tellers. So I am deeply concerned.
If you like Johnny's regular podcasts, think about making a donation at either patreon.com/Johnny Gould or buy him a coffee. He loves coffee. ko-fi.com/Johnny Gould.
In a sense, though, you were lucky, if that's the word, that you were all together. There is no guarantee that family, the children are with their parents. There's no guarantee that the elderly who need daily medication are with their loved ones. There's no one to show them courage in different ways.
You're absolutely right. And hence I said, there is nothing to compare. Besides the fact that I was a hostage and they are hostages, but there is nothing to compare. The era is different. The terrorists are different. The numbers are different, but they are next door. We know how to find them. We know it's extremely dangerous. And hence, in my logic, analysis, the means is through an enormous, non-stop pressure on Hamas with the assistance of the rest of the world, including, by the way, Arab countries. I think, and you know, that's taking a slightly distant view from the horrors here and their ramifications. I think what Hamas did is not only outrageous, but potentially will bring, hopefully, the Arab countries and Arab leaders, I mean the decent ones, the logical ones, to rethink their policies. You cannot coexist with such atrocities like the Nazis. And we all remember that it took the world a long time and millions of deaths to finally decide to join forces and finish World War II like they finished it. It cost the Jewish people 6 million. It cost other nations many millions more. I think we are in that type of event in terms of not magnitude of numbers, but magnitude of
consequences.
Yeah. Of consequences. Thank you. Exactly. And I do hope that the Arab leaders will take a close look at what's happening and rethink their policies and positions and maybe adopt the West Germany policy following World War II to make the Middle East the place that everybody who has a logical mind, decent, truthful, has integrity and wants peace for himself and his children can be. So out of this horrendous act with an outrageous number of casualties, something good should come. We owe that to the 1,500 and maybe more dead. And we owe that to Israel continuing to be the place on earth for Jews and Israelis. And last but not least, we are the chosen one and we are a beacon to the world. So we're going to show, with the help of Biden, the world, the Hezbollah and Iran and Hamas and whomever tries again to raise a hand on a kid or on a children or on a woman or on an elderly or on any civilian, we will teach not a very hard lesson, a once and for all lesson. To me, I apologize for going very, very high to the Dalai Lama's level. It should be simple, not complex. It should be very, very simple. When you do that, you get annihilated. You get eradicated out of the face of the earth. Now, the rest of you, once you don't have that military power, please rethink your education systems. Rethink the way that you're bringing up your child. Rethink your ceremonies on Friday night in the mosques. And if you're ready, then we'll sit with you. We have the IDF. We won't use it because you don't have anything to raise a weapon against them. Then we can sit and discuss how to flourish the Middle East. But first and foremost, you should vomit those people out. Those are the people you chose, you elected, and you're going to pay the price, although we are telling you go south. But you know that Hamas is blocking their own population from evacuating Gaza Strip to the south. So Israel is, even though has any justification to simply wipe out Gaza, any justification, we still notify them and tell them to clear this neighborhood and that neighborhood, and Hamas blocks them. And not only that, they misfired a missile, and now they're trying to put it on us. So the time of fake news, like they love to some extent in the States, and regretfully to some extent in the last several years in Israel, the time for fake news and lies is over. Only truth, hard, crystal clear truth, has come. It's an outrageous price, Johnny.
Yeah.
But it is time. Enough is enough.
And this modern warfare is expedited more swiftly in the social media era. The Nazis hid their crimes, but they recorded them in great detail. Whereas these savages streamed them live on head cams, even some of them shot down as the cameras still rolled. And in this modern day world where we are exposed to brutal, terrible video that we can never unsee, perhaps it's the human videos that are perhaps even more impactful. I can't get out of my head the young Israeli boy sort of poked with sticks by older boys. That really hurt me and upset me as much as all the other gruesome videos from the Peace Festival. And I think the worst thing I saw was the father who, in his depth of mourning, cheered that his little girl had been killed before she could be taken hostage by those savages. As a hostage yourself, do you understand that, father?
I can relate to that. I'll tell you a story and then I'll come back to the regretfully sad point that you raised. When they started shooting, when the IDF stormed our terminal on 3rd of July, 11 o'clock p.m., By the way, on that Saturday on noontime, I sat with a friend of mine and played backgammon. And during throwing the dice, I told him, "You'll see tonight at midnight, the IDF will come." And he was like putting his hand on my forehead, and because he thought I had fever, because we had dysenteria breaking in the day before, because the toilets were clogged, so, and everybody became sick. So he thought I'm raising fever and hallucinating. And he also told me your father is an Air Force navigator. He checked the distances and the airplanes, and there is no possibility for an IDF rescue mission because they can fly here, but they don't have anywhere to refuel on the way back. So it's a one-way mission. So I looked him in the eye and told him, "I know what my father said. You'll see, tonight they'll come." I was wrong. They came at 11 p.m., not at midnight. But the point, Johnny, is when the war inside the terminal and outside the terminal started, I find myself lying on the ground in the entrance to the toilets that was the only place in the terminal that was to some extent shielded from direct fire coming from the outside. I didn't recall what my prediction or my prophecy from noontime that day. But I find myself lying on the ground face down with my mother, who is shorter than me. She's 1.50 meters, covering me with her body. Not shouting, not yelling, not screaming. I was not crying. I was simply murmuring to the ground. And with all the shots and shrapnel and whatever hit the ground and the walls and the shouts, she lowered her head and asked me, "Benny, what are you saying?" Said, "Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. God, please help us. Don't let us die here. Personal pray. That's all." But she covered with her body, my body, or my, because she said literally that if the shots hit her, they may stop the bullets and I will survive. Coming back to your question, I don't know this father, but he saw it for what it was. He saw the horrors right and left of him. And as awkward and maybe intolerable to hear a father saying such a statement, I understand. I fully understand him, because he wanted to save his daughter from those, I don't know, I don't, even monsters, you know, we have some kids movies with very, very nice monsters. So even monsters is not a word for the level of hatred, evil, dark mind of such people. I'd rather don't give them anything, certainly not labeling them.
Yeah.
They simply need to be wiped out of the face of the earth. And not Hamas, simply.
Yeah. And Hamas has shown how wicked they are. They'll use hostages as they see fit to apply pressure on the Israeli government and psychological pain upon its people through videos on social media. Some of them have already come out. Are they still useful to Hamas alive? And I say that because they're a different kind of terrorist to the ones that confronted you in Entebbe.
Mm-hmm. I really don't know. Johnny, I really don't know. On one hand, you see the videos and you hear the horror stories of you know, shooting babies, decapitating people, tearing limbs apart, like really the worst of the worst of the worst. And on the other hand, stories about several teams that took hostages, but sat with them in their homes and even several ones that took them back to Gaza. But right before they crossed the border, the fence back, released a mother with two kids and said, "We are not touching women and kids." To me, that says that there are different, I don't know even how to call those people, but there are different types of Hamas that took hostages in, and there are some that are willing to keep the hostages alive because there is a reason for that. Now, what would be that reason if they truly believe that we're going to eradicate them? I honestly don't know. I'm trying to logically analyze something that is completely illogical, Johnny. One cannot rationalize. I said at the beginning, and I repeat it now, I think the only way is to put such a pressure that they will go down on their knees and ask us to take the prisoners back. This is the type of policy and actions I expect the IDF and my government to do. Give them a 24-hour deadline or a 2-hour deadline. Either you release all of them or you can mark this neighborhood as gone. After 2 hours and 1 minute, it's gone. Another hour, another one. Another hour, another one. Yes, you may ask the very, very delicate and hard question. So what would be with the hostages? If the IDF has any other solution, and I'm not even close to the circles that discuss such abilities, nor am I to the government or cabinet discussions on that, by all means, do that. But you know, to some extent, what Putin would have done in a case like that. No ifs, no buts.
Yeah.
Now, or you're gone. Completely. And we call it in Hebrew, "Bala Bayit Ishtagea," like the owner of the house went mad. Like,
yeah, I mean, he killed everyone. He killed hostages too.
Yeah, yeah. So he's like a different beast. But Israel needs to deliver a very clear, undebatable message, both to Hamas, as to the north, as to the east in Iran, and as to Europe as well. If we're not doing this right, you are next. And you have tons of those in your backyard for the last few decades. So don't fool with us. Simply don't. Europe will be gone. And those people who do not take a wider view of history and forecast for not the next year or so, but for the next 20, 50, 100, 200 years, do not simply fully understand the situation and what they are dealing with. What we are dealing with now, we understand. We were surprised, but it took us 28 hours to, you know, get a grasp on it. It cost us a lot of casualties, but no army in the world, no army in the world within 28 hours will take control of the situation and move to offense. No army in the world. So I fully count on IDF's ability, although it was surprised.
Yeah.
I cannot regretfully say the same on our government. But thankfully enough, we are the people of Israel, and hundreds of thousands and millions of civilians simply work around the clock to support IDF, to support the evacuated families, to support the hostage families, and to do whatever is needed. And we're doing it without the government, not yes. with.
That is the one thing that always strikes me about Israeli society, that it's a self-mobilization. It's what we call here, which we don't achieve, big society. The IDF is us. It's the collective of the Israeli. And it's not just military, it's also social, it's societal. And the response has been from the ground up, not the top down. And I think that is a message to the world, a light unto the world. And I think that every Jewish person around the world who understands Israel, who's been to Israel, who is a Zionist, who supports the state of Israel, is rightly very, very proud. Benny, when you talk about absolute action, don't, otherwise we will raise one of your areas. Don't. Another 24 hours later, we'll raise another one of your areas to deter Hamas from causing any harm to the hostages. This is a strip of land with a population of just over 2 million. It's the size of the West Midlands here in England.
Yeah.
There is a terror tunnel infrastructure believed to be of 500 kilometers in size. My question is, every action has a consequence. This is a very dangerous rescue. It's not in one place. When Hezbollah have 150,000 rockets pointing at Israel, when we know that Hamas are growing in popularity in Judea and Samaria, when we know the Syrians also can break off from their civil war and start using the Iranian land bridge to invade Israel from that time, we only have a certain amount of time to carry this out, especially in the cauldron of public opinion. We have seen how the horrors of that Saturday morning are now down the news running order.
Listen, you're asking me to be a statesman, a political, an army analyst, and several other jobs. One thing that I know about myself, and that maybe needs to be said if it's not already clear to your audience, I'm very decisive in my positions. I'm not a political snake trying to describe a complex situation with finesse or with rounded up sentences or phrases. I speak my mind, but I'm entitled to my mind and to my beliefs. And my belief is that we do not have any choice but to put Hamas on their knees, begging us to take the hostages back. Now, with respect to the thousands of rockets in Hezbollah or Iran, my, again, very, very personal view is that Biden saw it right on Saturday for what it's worth. Some Israelis today, including some that sits in this cabinet, in our Israeli cabinet, do not see the full picture, do not fully understand the magnitude of the situation. I saw it, Biden saw it, and several other millions in Israel and certainly around the world saw it. I think the reason Biden sent one carrier and now a second one, even before, if you recall 50 years ago, Golda needed to fly in the midst of the battle to Henry Kissinger in Washington and to persuade the shipment of arms to support Israel because we were facing a very problematic situation. We fought, I think, five different states with five different armies. We're fighting a terror organization and a horrendous Satan, but we're fighting a terror organization. Hezbollah is a terror organization. The only army is Iran. My personal belief, and maybe it's a naive belief and hope, that we can handle the three of them with lots of casualties, of course, to us, but many, many more casualties to them. I think we can handle the three of them, if need be.
Benny, can we talk about how the hostage crisis ended for you personally at Entebbe?
Sure. So they stormed in, and it was like war within a small terminal. But after several minutes, the gunshots and grenades and submachine guns and machine guns within the terminal stopped. The fight outside continued, but internally, in the terminal, it stopped. And somebody shouted, "Hey, there are Israeli soldiers here." And I remember I was lying on the ground and my mother on top of me. So I remember raising my head and looking at two soldiers, Amir Ofer on the right and Amos Goren on his left. They are from Amnon's team, which was one of the teams of Sayeret Matkal, our commander unit, commanded by Yoni Netanyahu, who stayed outside directing the various teams to different doors. And I looked at them. They were wearing Ugandan soldiers.
Uniforms.
Outfits. Uniforms. They were holding Kalashnikovs, AK-47s, and not the Israeli IDF weapons. They were wearing white caps. We call it Kova Tembel. It's like a hat, but, you know, a simple hat that sits like that, a white to distinguish them from others. And Amir was looking down at us and saying, "Shalom, banu lakachat etchem habayta. Shalom, we came to take you home. Gather your things. Go outside. There are other soldiers waiting for you on the tarmac. They will take you to an airplane who will fly you back home." So I went hand in hand with my father from the back of the terminal to the front, because the exit to the tarmac was on the front. And what was our home for a week, or prison, in a matter of a few minutes became a battlefield and a bloodshed area. And I recalled the horrors there. A good friend of us, of the children, of the kids of Entebbe, Jean-Jacques Maimoni, was mistakenly identified as a terrorist and was like full of bullets. And I saw him on the way out, and I was, you know, dumb enough even to ask my father, "Is he dead?" I knew, but, you know, I needed to the stamp of approval. And then we went out to the tarmac, and several were boarded on a couple of jeeps and driven elsewhere. We didn't see or hear the C-130. It was waiting like 500 meters. It was a very dark night in Uganda, in Africa. So we started running together, the four of us, and with a Golani fighter on one side and another Golani fighter on the other side. Then the fire broke again. And so they asked us to go down on our knees and wait until the fire stops. And I remember, while kneeling down, looking backwards and seeing the MiG-15s and 17s of the Ugandan Air Force, being lit up like Chanukiah, you know, like in Chanukah, one after the other. So that's a recollection that is very strongly cemented in me. We boarded the airplane, we flew to Nairobi, refueled, and then flew to Israel, where we met Rabin and where we met the other ministers, and then flew again from an Israeli Air Force base that we landed first to Ben Gurion Airport, where all the families and press waited for us. But all that story, all that long story, serves as only an entrance to the main point. Because you asked me, how did you deal with that? And what became of you? My parents, at that point of time, made, I think, one of the bravest decisions that a parent can do. We landed in Israel in July 4th, 1976. On July 14th, 1976, we took off again and made the bar mitzvah trip in coast to coast in the United States for a whole month. And the message, without saying a word, from my parents to Ron and myself, is that whatever happens, even a terror attack, we're safe, we're sound, we're mentally strong, we board the plane, we fly directly, not through Athens and Paris, with El Al, not with Air France, but we fly directly to New York, we take a car, and we do the Route 66 coast-to-coast plan as was originally planned to the letter. Now, that cemented in me. That and what happened during that week cemented in me and became very useful over the years. I would just say, you know what Hagomel is. I'm 60 and I've managed to say Hagomel already 4 or 5 times. So
tell the audience, because a lot of our audience isn't Jewish.
Okay.
Tell us.
Hagomel is a Jewish blessing. I'm sorry, you should translate. What does Hagomel, who he gives praise, or who he gives
salvation?
So that's a short prayer that it's a custom to do in according to Jewish religion when you are saved from an outrageous event, or if you survive a car accident, or if you survive a terror attack, or if you survive a grave illness. So you pray to God and say, thank you for giving me life to continue and live. That's the gist of it. And of course, the first one was Entebbe, but since I'm as my mother calls me, Pundit, or a bandit, actually. I do extreme sports and things like that, so I managed to do another 3 Hagomels or 4 Hagomels later on. But the mental strength and the ability to handle extreme, tough situations without losing balance or control and see clearly what needs to be done, those traits were born.
Inspired. Your parents were inspiration.
In that week in Entebbe, and since I was 13, which is the right age of the end of the childhood and beginning of adulthood, I always say the same sentence. I went to Entebbe, a boy, and I came a week later, a grown-up, an adult. To sum it up, Entebbe for me was never a trauma. I never called it a trauma. It was a very, very bad experience. But I never used the word trauma. And the main reason for that are my parents and, to some extent, my character.
And you mentioned the fallen hero of Entebbe, the heroics of Yoni Netanyahu, Benjamin's brother, killed saving you and the other Israeli hostages. Now, this hostage crisis must have very special resonance, whatever you think of him personally.
I beg to differ. Forcefully, I beg to differ. I know Yoni Netanyahu and the rest of the 220 fighters that boarded those airplanes on Friday, July 3rd, 1976, went to a mission with possible no return. They knew what they were facing. And the speech that Yoni gave his commando team in Sharm el-Sheikh, down south, before they took off in the afternoon of Saturday, of Friday, sorry, of Saturday, to arrive at 11 p.m. to Entebbe, the speech that he gave them on the ground is cemented in their hearts until they die. I know all of them. They're all good friends of mine. If you heard the Biden speech, that's the level of speech Yoni gave his soldiers. He told them about Zionism. He told them about Judaism. He told them about being an Israeli is Arvut Hadadit, or Kol Israel Chaverim, all Israel are friends. Kol Israel Arevim Zeh Lezeh, all Israel are collateral one for another. And he told them, nothing will go according to plan. Remember, kill the terrorists and save the hostages. This is the ball. Don't take your eyes off the ball. So he was a great leader. And although I didn't know him personally, it took me 40 years to go up to his cemetery in Herzl, because I carried him on my back. I felt as if I lost a family member, a big brother. Long live my real big brother. I read everything about him. I met his then future to be wife. I met all of his friends. I interviewed them. I know not everything I need to know, but I know a lot about him. So when I talk about Yoni, I talk about Yoni after talking with his comrades and friends, those who went to fight with him, not only in Entebbe, but many years back. Real leader, real Zionist, real brave, and knows exactly what needs to be done, especially in harm's way. And it both amazes me, Johnny, and makes me sick at the same time that him and our prime minister carried the same genes. It's unbelievable the level of distance between these two. And I regret that we lost Yoni and we don't have him as a leader these days. Deeply, deeply, deeply regret. So, in a short answer to your shorter question, I don't think the situation and being a brother of a lost soldier gives him any discount in my eyes. Actually, it's the other way around. From what he has been doing over the last 10 months since this government he's elected, even from the outset of this horror war, is nothing but outrageous, taking care of himself, being egocentric, and not taking care of the people. And you know, there are people saying, no, it's not the time. There will be a time at 6 after the war to deal with everybody. He's gone. Everybody knows that. He knows that. But it doesn't have even the slightest of decencies. I'm not even trying to compare him to his brother, because that's shameful to Yoni's name. The name Netanyahu will be remembered for the history of Israel, but that one of Yoni Netanyahu. The name of Bibi Netanyahu will be erased from the history of Israel, and rightfully so.
Thank you for your clarity, Benny. And so the follow-up question to that very emotional soliloquy, that statement about the two brothers, is, given what's happened in the last year with judicial reform, given what happened with the horror of the intelligence failure. Can I ask you, Benny, does the IDF in 2023 inspire the same confidence as the IDF in 1976?
Certainly. Certainly. Take a look at the generals in reserves, Israel Ziv, Noam Tibon, Yair Golan, and others. I'm naming just three. There is a cabinet of the army, a civil one, consulting the chief of staff, who took responsibility, but said, let me finish this war. And I have full confidence in him. And you say, you mentioned the intelligence failure. Yes, but it's not only intelligence, and it's not only operational, and it's not only logistical, and it is certainly not staying at the level of the army. Army, intelligence, Mossad, Shabak, government work together. And let's remember, out of the last 15 years, who was the prime minister who directed policies, okay? So he will not shy away from being fully responsible and paying the ultimate price. But IDF, after the major hit they took, as I said, 28 hours, took hold on all positions and started acting offensively. No army in the world would have done so as such a swift move, even after taking such a hard blow. So I and the rest of the people of Israel have nothing but strong support and faith to our army and to our army in reserves and to the generals leading it. We need to put aside the government that will not interfere with what needs to be done. I think the government, lessly so, the IDF more so, will do what's needed to be done. IDF, even though took a major blow on Saturday before the last, is still the best army in the world. No ifs, no buts. As you well said, it's a strange thing for the people of Israel who really don't need a leader because they are leaders by themselves, and out of nothing comes this cohesiveness. After I visited the family, the hostage families, I went to the civil war room. There is a civil war room that was built by civilians on Saturday morning. I visited it yesterday. Johnny, I'm a high-tech executive over the last 20-something years, okay? There are dozens of rooms of people working there to identify casualties based on various technologies. I visited the underground parking. It's like a huge logistical depot center divided by sections in various packages of who needs toothbrush and who needs shoes and who needs laptops and who needs food and whatever. And it's operational by hundreds of volunteers 24/7. And it's met. And now imagine if we wanted or needed to do it through governmental bureaucratic channels. We would have lost three wars by the time somebody would sign a check in the government. So our civilians are rising up to the minute, fully understand the grasp and the magnitude of it, and simply acting upon it. Government can only interfere and delay us, this government. And by the way, if you want a different angle on the Entebbe strike, I would dream of a political Entebbe strike. One that takes down the government and the next morning raises another one. We have these provisions, actually, we have these provisions in the law in Israel. So what needs to be done? Five out of the Likud party members that will raise to the event, salvage themselves from being scorned and maybe thrown to jail in the day after, and become not heroes, but facilitators of bringing down this government and bringing another one in place in a matter of an hour. Now, what will happen to my prediction? As I said, I'm not a political expert, but I feel it, Johnny, much like I felt that the IDF will come on midnight on Saturday. What will happen is that the spirit that you see now in Israel will be raised by an order of magnitude. One. Two, the civilians will work with a good professional government and expedite and accelerate the release of the hostages and what needs to be done to end this war quickly and efficiently. But last and very, very not least, we will send a very, very clear message to the area. If need be to replace a government during wartime through an Entebbe political event, we know how to do that as well. So simply as Biden said, don't.
I am certain, just as there was a political reckoning for Golda Meir after the Yom Kippur War and Menachem Begin after Lebanon in 1982, there will be, as you say, a ground-up reckoning for Benjamin Netanyahu. I'm certain of it. Benny Davidson, your recollections have been extremely moving for our audience, and I thank you very much for joining me here on Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
Johnny, thank you very much for the time and the opportunity. I would go to the other end of the world and then some to say what I have to say and to help whomever needs help. We are in a grave situation. I'm very confident that we will do what needs to be done and come up with the upper hand. I want to make sure that this is not just an upper hand, but a real change in the Middle East and potentially worldwide. Terror is not an option. Not anymore.
Benny, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, John.
Magnificent.
Thank you, and we'll stay in touch.
Of course we will. And again, thank you for the time. I know it's been busy. I know.
No, it's okay. And I really appreciate the opportunity. And you know, you said 30 minutes, we're nearly an hour and a quarter. And I'm actually sitting at my parents' home. They're both alive. And
thank God.
They're nearly, my mother just turned 89 a few days ago. My father is turning 89 on December 4th. So they're both good. I'm sitting in an upper room. They're not disturbing me. They know that I'm busy. And I'm actually very, very thankful because I will send you the link to the interview on the American TV.
Yes, please.
There earlier. And you know, the difference between an interview with a live network on a news event is quite limiting in your ability to share your views and thoughts and analysis and what's in your gut that you want to speak out, because it's television, it's working like a New York Minute. So thankfully enough, Johnny, you invited me to participate in a long podcast. My ability to sit for over an hour and share what I've been sharing over the net is already a minuscule compared to what I've been able to share with you and through you with the audience. How big it is,
it's a big audience, and I really feel that as well. I really feel it. You've transferred your gut to my gut as well with this discussion.
I just hope it roams around mainly with European public and people who are public leaders. And, you know, if anyone approaches you and wants to contact me.
Of course, or, and they do, and they
whatever,
do.
As I said, I'll go to the end of the world and then some more to help Israel realize what needs to be realized now.
Johnny Gould's Jewish State is brought to you with Dangor Education.